This is Sending Signals, a show about music and creativity. I'm your host, Matt Royal. Welcome to the show. Our guest this month, jazz legend Digby Fairweather. Wilco keyboard player Michael Jorgensen. If you head down to the basement floor of a former public library in Southend-on-Sea in Essex, you'll find something really unusual, the Jazz Centre UK. It's a large space with side rooms. There's ample room for live performances, film screenings, and to house the impressive collection of jazz recordings, reference materials, and memorabilia. One of the key figures in the inception and running of the Jazz Centre UK is local jazz royalty Digby Fairweather. Digby has had a long career as a cornet player, but is also known as a broadcaster and a writer. A gregarious and intensely likeable character, now 73, Digby still plays regularly, hosting monthly jazz nights. But it seems to me he's as interested in the curation and preservation of jazz as he is in playing. He popped round to talk to a podcast and we had a great time. We talked about the notion of genre in the 21st century. Is it still a relevant way to categorise music? As well as the balance between preservation and being forward-thinking. I think it's a really cool chat and I hope you enjoy it. Welcome to the show, mate.
Thank you very much, Matt. It's lovely to be here.
How are you?
I was never better. Never better.
Never better.
As far as I'm aware,
yeah.
I feel great. I'm playing a lot. I had a wonderful gig last night with Daryl Sherman, the American singer, at the Pheasantry. And I've been working with Daryl for the last 4 days. She's an old friend. Marvellous singer, great pianist, and musically life is great.
That's fantastic. Well, you've certainly been busy. I live in Southend, so you're a local legend.
Absolutely. Well, I don't know about legend.
The question I wanted to ask really is, how famous are you?
Oh, I don't think I'm famous at all. I mean, fame now is quantified by people like Elton John,
yeah,
or the rock stars who exist in a firmament, which didn't exist when I was coming up,
yeah,
which I call the music industry.
Huh.
Now, that doesn't mean that they're not immensely talented, but they grew up in an expanding industry where you could truly become a superstar. Yeah. And in my opinion, in jazz, you still can't, not really. Apart from one or two very lucky people like Jamie and certainly Jules Holland, who is a remarkable man in many ways.
Yeah.
For me, he doesn't exactly define jazz, as I understand it. But people like me are only reasonably well known within a very small circumference of activity.
Yeah.
That's as far as I go.
And with jazz, I guess a lot of it gets canonized almost a bit later on. So now like Coltrane and Miles Davis, and they're kind of stars, but then they're not around.
I think it helps to die.
Yeah,
well, it had occurred to me as a possibility at one stage, actually.
Well, we'll give it a bit of time.
I think a canonization is a very good word for it, you know.
Yeah.
And I think people like Coltrane, and in my day, people like Big Spiderbeck.
Yeah.
And certainly Louis Armstrong, I think, has managed to be canonized.
Yeah.
Some of the other ones, maybe not so much.
Yeah.
But there is this new generation of musicians coming up, in my view, who are actually researching back into the pre-Beatle era.
Yeah.
It certainly happens in London a lot. Less down here, but I have some pretty scintillating examples at the Jazz Centre,
yeah,
of young musicians who are rediscovering the basic tenets of jazz, and I think that's great.
Well, we'll come back to the Jazz Centre in a minute. So you, you started playing cornet at what age?
I picked up a trumpet for the first time, I think I was 12.
Yeah, and so was Beiderbecke and Louis Armstrong an influence on
that
decision?
Oh, yeah. Totally, yeah. I mean, I knew that I'd fallen in love with what used to be called, and still is sometimes, Dixieland music.
Yeah.
Because I heard an old band leader called Sid Phillips, who was a very skilled clarinet player, who had a marvellous Dixieland band on Radio 2. or what was then the Light Programme.
Yeah.
So I fell in love with that. And then when I think I was 11, my father found a house on the Essex Marshes called Stannitz. It's actually on the old Ordnance Survey maps.
Yeah.
It's an old manor house, which had been turned into two farmers' cottages.
Yeah.
And when we moved there in 1958, I think, would you know, there's a jazz band in the village led by, well, which had four young players in it, including a pianist called Derek Wood. And that's the point at which I, the first time I heard their little band, and I heard jazz in the flesh, then I just devoured it.
Yeah.
And I didn't really want to do anything else at all. Yeah. I didn't want to go to school, didn't want to watch movies. The only thing that interested me slightly later on was girls.
Yeah.
But apart from that, it was jazz, jazz, jazz all the way.
So you've been very involved in running the Jazz Centre UK.
Yes.
In Southend. I went to the opening, which was fun, and you had guys from the Humphrey Littleton band there.
I saw you. Who, absolutely.
I bored with asking stories about the Radiohead session
a
few years ago.
Which was a very big thing for Humph.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems to me that you're as passionate about the archiving and preservation of jazz as you are about playing.
I think that came a bit later, but yes, you're right. The story is actually that... Well, it's quite a funny story. To begin with, of course, I was totally fueled by playing the music.
Yeah.
But as I moved from being a librarian when I was in my 20s to being a full-time professional musician, that suddenly made me very aware of the kind of cartoon landscape that jazz musicians live in. They're a bit like self-employed. Well, they are self-employed people.
Yeah.
So as opposed to the library, where I had the Library Association in London for my studies, and, of course, I had sick pay, annual increments, holiday pay.
Yeah.
I suddenly moved into this scarifying routine of no pay, no play, or rather no play, no pay, right?
Yeah.
So that was a shock.
Yeah.
And I was also very aware of the lack of any kind of cultural recognition of jazz people.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people think that's probably a bit boring, but what really fueled it was in 1982, a group of people in London called the Jazz Centre Society, nice people for the most part, had the idea of setting up a cultural centre for jazz in Covent Garden, in Floral Street. And I went along to a couple of meetings where they were planning all this, and they achieved about £3 million of public funding from the GLC, from the Arts Council, and from the Pilgrim Trust. So I went to a few of the meetings, and I did notice there was quite a lot of red wine being drunk around the tables.
Yeah.
And in 1986, the headline came out, receivers called in, accountants called in, all the money's gone, there will never be a jazz centre in Britain. Well, being as I was a professional musician, I received the cultural lashes along with the rest of our community. Oh, jazz, well, nobody's very interested in jazz now, are they, since the Beatles? And on top of that, fact that we don't like the music much, they're a very misty community. And I felt that because of my grounding in a normal 9-to-5 job. So in 1986, same year, I went to my old boss at the library and I said, we need a cultural research center for jazz in this country. Because at the same time, a friend of mine was running something called the British Oral Jazz History. Sorry, this is a bit of a long story. His name was Chris Clark. And he was organizing interviews with most of the senior members of our profession. Very good ones, of which I did quite a few, actually. Anyway, in 1985, I did a TV show called 50 Years of Nat Kinella. And I met with a man called Chris Clark, who ran the National Sound Archives Jazz Division. And I found out that there was actually no research collection in Britain about jazz. So I went to an old boss of mine at the library and said, can you find me a room? And in 1988, 2 years later, we opened something called the National Jazz Archive, which I founded and which became the National Research Centre for the British Jazz Culture. It's in Loughton. And that tootled along very nicely, gathered strength, and it's still going strong 30 years later.
Yeah.
But the way the Jazz Centre started was as an annex, an outreach department for the National Jazz Archive in Loughton. But while we were setting that up in the Beecroft Art Gallery in Southend, it turned out that we were able to acquire the original work desk and trumpets and correspondence of Humphrey Lyttelton, who was really one of the figureheads of British jazz from 1948 until he died in 2008. We got that, but when I took it back to the National Jazz Archive in Loughton, they said, oh, we don't do that. We don't collect artifacts, and we don't collect recorded sound because we haven't got the room, and we don't do films or anything like that, and we can't collect the Lyttelton desk. So I said, you mean you really want to jettison this huge cultural amenity, you know, this artifact? And they said, yes, we do. So that caused a little bit of argy-bargy. So to make the story as short as possible, in 2016, we registered a separate charity as a sister ship to the NJA. And our purpose was to collect classic recorded sound, to show movies, to have live performances, which the NJA couldn't do, and to have a heritage room where we collected things like Louis Armstrong's trumpet, Sir John Dankworth's first piano, Humphrey Lyttelton's collections, and much more.
Do you feel like the legacy of jazz is underappreciated in general still? Do you think it's improved from what it was in the 80s?
I think the answer to that is a big, fat yes. I mean, I can remember, because I'm 73 years old now, when jazz was youth culture. But there was this extraordinary time when the Beatles arrived. And it was very difficult to define why they were so good and so different. But what they did was they cleared the stale air out of Tin Pan Alley, if you will. And they also began the kind of music culture which gradually sidelined jazz. And I remember in the 70s and 80s going up to Maida Vale with my band and recording inserts of Dixieland music for things like the Jimmy Young Show, the daytime shows. But then they went over to what they call turntable culture. And they also have this rather terrifying graph on the wall where they work out how old are the people that are listening. So there comes a point where you get swiped off the graph. So even in the 80s, I remember some of the morning presenters occasionally maybe playing something by Lou Stone from the 30s, because the people who would have liked that hadn't yet tumbled off the graph. But people like me are now officially off the end of the graph and under the ground somewhere, officially. So it's a turntable culture. And even the Beatles are regarded as passé, really. And there's a huge media concentration on rock music and the pop culture. The BBC alone has at least three dedicated stations, Radio 1, Radio 2, and I think Radio 6, if that's still going. Six Music. And it's a very, very bad case, in my view, of what I would call unprompted and unrecognized inadvertent censorship. And it's only very recently that, very slowly, the BBC has caught on to the fact that jazz has triumphantly survived this censorship and is turning out more and more young jazz musicians than ever. And I'm going to speak out and say that I think a lot of the current people who control the industry have a great deal to answer for. And it's only because of the durability of our art form and the talent of our young players that it has survived so triumphantly. It could have died. In fact, when the Beatles came along, there was a moment when I thought, we've had it. This is going to be a little tiny niche art form that more or less died by the 1970s. But of course it's not. I mean, you go into London now and you'll find 200 or 300 young people in a single club listening to the masters. Billie Holiday, Louis Armstrong. They've circuited this public culture and said, no, nuts to that. We're doing our own discoveries.
So a couple of things have happened, I think. One is that there's less of a monoculture now with the internet, and there's so many different ways to hear and experience and discover things. There's less tribalism in music, so people can discover what they really like. There's less being sort of pushed down a certain path.
You're so right.
The other thing is that genre lines are so blurred now. Mm. And even in pop music, take someone like Ed Sheeran, one of the biggest stars on the planet. Is he a singer-songwriter? Is he a rapper? Is he a pop musician? Well, he's kind of all of those things, you know? And I find it's interesting. I think the same thing's happened with jazz. You had, like, this new wave of British jazz bands like Polar Bear, who are bringing in sort of a bit of electronic elements to jazz. And like Kamasi Washington, who's doing amazingly well at the moment, he's kind of done it because he did session work with Kendrick Lamar. And the lines between sort of rock and urban and these kind of genre lines have been so blurred now.
Oh, yeah.
So I think you maybe have to look harder for it. But jazz has been able to sort of come back in through a side door, I think,
agree,
in a way.
Agree completely. I mean, Go-Go Penguin, Snarky yeah. Puppy, absolutely. And it's a very interesting thing, actually, because jazz has always progressed and taken on different hues according to what's going on around it.
Yeah.
And I think my personal view is that some of the hardline jazz people that I know are not terribly keen on Snarky, for example. Mm-hmm. They say whatever jazz there is too hard to find.
Yeah.
And I think there'll always be the hard line of people who say, no, no, we need to go back to Duke Ellington. We need to go back to Armstrong, yeah. Charlie Parker. Huh. It can't be helped. But of course, you know, for the new generation, I don't in any way blame them for making their own discoveries and making their own developments. They have to, don't they?
Yeah. And that, to me, the ethos of jazz is that it can explore yep. territories and can, you know, like expand your mind, if you like, you know, and it can push boundaries and it's freeform. And so the concept of it being hardline jazz fans who are kind of traditionalist is kind of seems to me counterintuitive to what jazz is.
You know? I think that's a very good point. And it's certainly an Oxford debate in the making.
Yeah.
I mean, my friend Alan Barnes has just done an album which relates very strongly to what I'd call the classic principles, the classic merce of jazz, as laid down by Duke and Basie. It's still enormously creative. And this to me is interesting, actually, because to me, the definition of jazz was actually very well sent out by the great philosopher Louis Armstrong. He said, you don't pose, never. No. Which makes an honest solo by a New Orleans trumpeter like Ken Collier as relevant as the latest thing by Snarky Puppy. Yeah. If they believe in it and it's not posturing,
yeah.
then it survives. And I think that's a great thing about jazz. It has what I used to call an inscape. I think that was Gerard Manley Hopkins invented that term for poetry, where he said the inscape of something is the recognition that there's something in there which is integral to the art form. And I think that's the only way you can define jazz, actually.
Well, what I like about the Jazz Centre is the fact you're doing performances there as well, because I think there's a danger yeah. in fetishizing the past with music. The past is always better, and while I totally want the past preserved, you know, and you don't want to be blinkered that only, you know, because then you might get young people only interested in what's current, and that's a very blinkered view as well. So you have to like appreciate the past. But I love the fact there's the potential for creating new memories in a place that's also documenting the past.
I completely agree with that. I mean, when we started it in 2016, I was very concerned that we were not seen as a heritage-only organisation.
Yeah.
That's what the National Jazz Archive is potentially a little more about, I think, yeah. with due respect. But no, I mean, the other thing was that people think of me, basically, as a traditional jazz musician.
Yeah.
So I think it'd probably be fair to say that we have skated around that area of programming generally at the centre.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want people locally or nationally to say, oh, well, it's Digby, so it's going to be all Dixieland and classic.
Yeah.
We've had people like Three Bop, which is a marvellous young vocalese band. We've had Elephant Talk, which is a terrific progressive band from guys at the Guildhall.
Right.
They are definitely in the mould of Snarky Puppy and those bands, and Go-Go, Penguin. And I think probably one or two people have said, hey, Dig, when are we going to have some swing?
Yeah.
I said, well, when we've absolutely established that our basic mission is to represent all areas of the jazz from the most classic to the most contemporary.
That's brilliant.
And I think in a way we've probably tended to lean more on the strictly contemporary for the risk factor that I mentioned, because people think of Digby as a traditionalist.
Well, look, if you'd just done it as a museum and as a backward-looking thing, it would essentially be like a glorified headstone for jazz.
Oh, sure.
Wouldn't it?
Exactly so.
Whereas this way, you're kind of preserving the past, but you're helping to give it a way forward.
Oh, yes.
Which is the only way it's going
to... And there's very interesting campaign at the moment to put jazz into primary schools, which is happening later. I think that's great, because people are influenced by what they hear when they're growing up.
Of course.
I can remember every album by the Beatles, because I adored the Beatles, actually.
Yeah.
You know, and it was also not only to do with the music, but with growing up, the experience of having your first love.
Yeah,
tied to all those things. And you can't do that by saying to somebody, here's a 78 of Freddie Randall. Not going to mean anything to them, is it?
The other thing, you do a monthly jazz night at the Cricketers just up the road.
Oh, yeah, we do.
Yeah, which has been, again, Southend's become a real kind of...
Hotbed
for jazz. And I really like you have Simon Spillet has come down.
Simon Spillet's been there a couple of times. He's dynamite.
He's brilliant.
He's wonderful. I mean, his hero originally, and still, I think, was the late, great Tubby Hayes.
Yeah.
And Tubby was an unbelievably great tenor player who played in America as easily and well as he did in Britain. He was a giant.
Yeah.
But Simon, I would not say this easily, has got very close to Tubby musically.
Yeah.
And when I listen to him, I think, yes, that could be Tubbs. He's not an ape. He's not an apist.
Yeah.
He doesn't ape Tubby.
No.
But his approach has similarities. And, of course, he's also the great Boswell for Tubby Hayes. He wrote the great book about Tubby, The Long Shadow of the Little Giant. He made a great DVD. He's followed up with an expanded book about Tubby. And he's initiated, I should think, probably getting on for a dozen reissues of unissued Tubby Hayes.
Yeah.
And believe me, it's great. Simon is one of my favourite guests.
He's so exciting to watch.
And, yeah.
It's a free entry night, isn't it?
And, I'm afraid it is, yes.
It's not so good for you.
We have a very generous budget,
yeah.
which is given to us by our delightful hosts, Carlo, Cassie and Christina.
Yeah.
And they've been friends of mine for years. And they have indeed given me the kind of budget which is dream-worthy, where I can get fine players, as well as, I'm not, by the way, in any way diminishing the powers of the local players.
Yeah.
I mean, we have Tim Huskisson, who's a world-class pianist and clarinetist.
Yeah.
We have Roger Kerfey, who's a fine bass player, who's worked with me all over the world.
Yeah.
And we have drummers like Alan Clark, Trevor Taylor, all of certainly national talent. So there's nothing wrong with the locals.
Yeah.
But when we can bring people down from town as well,
yeah.
It's stimulating for us to work with new people, hopefully on an equal basis.
Yeah.
And I'm very grateful we've been able to do it.
Yeah. Well, people listen to this all over the world, but if you're in the southeast of England, second Wednesday of the month normally, isn't it?
You are right, Matt. Absolutely. Second Wednesday of the month. Yeah. And the food's good too.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Digby.
It's total been a pleasure.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, mate.
And thank you, Matt. It was a pleasure for me too.
I really hope you're enjoying the podcast. If you are, please subscribe if you haven't already and tell your friends. Also, feel free to let me know what you think about each episode. You can find me on Twitter at Signals Podcast and on Instagram at Sending Signals Podcast. Thank you. Wilco have been a band for 25 years. The current lineup has remained unchanged for the past 15. They might be the best live band in the world. Their real breakthrough came in the early part of the century with the release of their album Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. Their label, Reprise Records at the time, hated the album so much they not only declined to release it, but they let the band walk away from their deal with the rights to the album. They streamed the album for free on their website and then signed with Nonesuch Records, who physically released the album. Here's the twist. Nonesuch Records were a subsidiary of the Warner Music Group, as was Reprise Records. Yankee Hotel Foxtrot has since sold over 670,000 copies. The album was a controversial one in that it really pushed the band from its country rock roots into sonically experimental art rock territory. And it was on the tour for this album that our guest today becomes associated with the band. Michael Jorgensen joined the band for the album's tour, performing sort of electronic sonic manipulations off stage. He joined the band officially for their next studio record, A Ghost Is Born, which won 2 Grammys. The band have just released a new album, Ode to Joy, and it's another challenging one. I must stress, Ode to Joy had not been released yet when we recorded this conversation, but it was great to be able to discuss Wilco's creative process with Michael.
Hello, is this Matt?
It is, yeah.
How are you?
I'm okay. I've been better, but I'm okay.
Oh no.
Yeah, we had our apartment had a burst pipe a few weeks ago while we was away, and we've had to move out, and so there's, you know, insurance chaos and.
Oh man.
But we're here.
Yes.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm sort of neck deep in a bunch of fabulous New York nostalgia. We flew straight from London to New York, and we did the Colbert show last night.
Yeah.
And then today we're going to tape an episode of Seth Meyers, another late night talk show, if you're not familiar.
Oh, I am.
But I grew up in New Jersey. My father was a recording engineer in Manhattan. And the part of town where the Ed Sullivan Theater is, where the Colbert Show tapes, is the same block that I used to work when I was like 22. And so I have a deep sort of like personal history and fondness for this part of town. And so.
But it's chaos around there. I hadn't been to New York before. We went last year for the first time. And so I saw where Colbert tapes, etc. And that part of town is. Madness.
Yeah, I mean, it can be for sure. Certainly in the summertime, it gets kind of nuts. But I mean, the whole, I would say maybe not the whole, but like a large percentage of recording studios in New York City were in this area. Like there's probably like a 2 square mile radius where the recording studios were in New York. And when I started working in like 92, 93, they were all sort of concentrated up here, and they were all still, you know, going strong. And Tom Schick, who is also an engineer from New York, he's been doing the last few Wilco records. He's relocated to Chicago. He and I were talking about like, man, I can't believe that, you know, it's only Sear Sound and Power Station. And there's another one that I'm forgetting. It's just insane. It's kind of crazy to watch that whole industry go away.
Yeah.
And also the guy who does the sound for the Colbert Report, not the Colbert Report, I'm sorry, the Late Show, Stephen
You
Colbert.
Are feeling nostalgic.
Exactly. But this goes even further back. Like the guy, Harvey, he was the sound guy at Letterman for the musical acts and then made the transition through to Colbert. But my dad trained him back in 73, something like that, 72. So there, like I said, there's like a lot of history and nostalgia and, you know, like, oh, that thing's gone and that's gone. And
what's the process of doing the Colbert Show like? I mean, I gather you get a sound check, and I'm guessing your crew load in advance. So you show up and what's sort of the, you know, how long does it take from start to finish?
It's funny for playing. We did Everybody Hides yesterday, so it's like maybe it's 3 minutes. I think it's like, you know, definitely on the sort of like shorter side of Wilco songs. But like the amount of time waiting around to just play for 3 minutes is always like humorous to me. But you're right. We the crew loads in, and then about 9 a.m. and then we show up at about 12:30. And then we do a sound check and then some camera blocking, and we go through the maybe four times.
Yeah.
Make sure that everybody can hear themselves and comfortable. And then there's a long break for a few hours until the taping starts at 5:30. And then we watch the show up in the dressing room, and then we go down and play the show, and then it's over before it begins, and then come back up, and then you're done.
Yeah.
So it's it's an all day affair.
Yeah. So your head must be spinning, because I guess you were in Manchester Friday, and then you were in London Saturday, where I saw you, and then so Monday you're back in New York doing Colbert. So when are you next home?
We're all going home for sort of an extended weekend, leaving tomorrow, and then we go back out to Toronto. I think we travel Monday. It's like, I don't know, I'm just sort of like really looking forward to being home with my family for a little bit before we head back out again.
Do you have kids?
Yeah, I've got two boys.
That must be incredibly difficult.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the pendulum swings hard both ways, because, you know, when I'm away, I'm away, but also just like when I'm home, you know. The kids are in school, and I use that time to work on other projects and composing and things and practicing, and then pick them up from school and make lunches, and I really enjoy it.
So this kind of feeds into something I wanted to talk about, which is the process of making Wilco records, because it's felt to me, just from what I've gleaned, that in recent years it seems very easy to get Wilco on tour, to get Wilco to commit to a tour as a unit. But it seems like it's harder to get the six of you to commit to a few months making a record. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's just a function of us like having done this for so long together, that I think that sort of part of that is that we all have this, we've developed the shorthand with each other.
Yeah.
And depending on the kind of record that Jeff has in mind, it can go like, it can be sort of labored over in kind of like a Ghost Is Born kind of way, where that was just like, you know, sort of seemingly endless time in the studio. And then, I mean, that's the record I started engineering on. Then I sort of like made the transition to the other side of the glass, as it were. But it was like several multi-week sessions in Chicago, then culminating in like 6 weeks in New York tracking, and then probably like another month and a half of overdubs and mixing. And I don't know how much you know about the making of Ode to Joy, but it was all of us together. Was fairly short. I think that was a really positive and healthy thing, because there wasn't tons of time to sort of like worry and fret over all the details, you know, to just sort of like get the shape and the spirit of what we were interpreting, that Jeff was trying to articulate, out and recorded. And like, you know, the first two songs on the record, at least for me, I mean, you know, Glenn is really, has this sort of like really kind of propulsive role, even more, I don't know, it's hard to describe, because it's like, it's less about a drum kit and more about
the sound,
like rhythm.
Okay.
Yeah. And also like the performance and like the sort of construction of the drum takes in the studio.
So here's how I understand, here's how I understand what has happened. You had a period of time blocked to make a record. Things started chipping away at that time, like based on sort of other members having other things on. And so Jeff and Glenn went ahead and started demoing the record. And those demos ended up being the basis for the record. So you've kind of got Jeff's songs, but with an emphasis on Glenn's parts.
Yeah, and then we would kind of come in and, decorate the Christmas tree, but kind of treat it as if Glenn was playing with us at the time. You know, it's like kind of a full band overdub.
Yeah.
There was part of me that really wanted to just let go and not be kind of ultra concerned with the harmonic structure of a song, and some of them are a little bit kind of like modal, where there's not a lot of key changes or things. So there's like a lot of, you know, sort of like technically there's like lots of notes that'll work over all of it. But I was trying to just find like notes that turned into a sound, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, rather than just like a part. I guess it is a part, but it's like, you know, just like, how can I, like, what can I do with just the piano sound and just try to, you know, find some secret sauce that is like very specific. So, and then I think that that's probably more evident on the Before Us song, which is the second one. But the first track, Bright Leaves, is pretty much an improvisation.
Right.
Like, as I was hearing it, kind of, maybe not for the first time, but playing it for the first time and just taking risks, because it's just the studio, it doesn't really, there's no, nobody's going to ask for their money back before the record comes out. Yeah. You know, if there's like a weird piano move or something. But it was kind of liberating to just like, I'm just not going to be as precious about this process in for that particular case than I have been in the past. And then conversely, there are other songs where there was very sort of specific voicings of chords, and being very kind of respectful or true to the sort of the song. And Love Is Everywhere is a good example of that. Like, there's the, technically it's called Spread Triad, but that piano part is very like what it is on the record is what I play live, you know, versus the other songs where there's a few sort of touchstone moments, but there's a lot of freedom in the middle of it. So
yeah, so I've got two I guess two observations. One is that I guess as a fan, because Jeff has been more prolific as a solo artist recently, and he put out like Tweedy, which was a double record, and then he's put out Warm and then Warmer. You know, Jeff is a key part of what makes Wilco great, obviously, but then from a fan point of view, he's not Wilco, you know, because you've got such big musical personalities in the band. You know, you're possibly the best live band in the world, you know. And so as a fan, the concept of the new Wilco album being a Jeff Tweedy solo album with Wilco overdubs is not that appealing, you know, because you want to feel, although the process is harder for you, you know, you kind of want a Wilco statement record that's got the band's DNA throughout. And so I think I've not heard the record yet because it's not out till Friday. So that's one observation. And then the other is that from what I've read and the way you've described it, there's a lot going on in this record in terms of the actual sounds and the sonics. And so it's been incredibly brave of you to debut these songs live before they're out, because Glenn's snare sound on Bright Leaves is going to sound a bit different in every room, you know, and our brains aren't going to be able to fill in what they would normally fill in, you know, between the difference between sort of knowing the record and hearing it live. Your kind of brain can sort of substitute a little bit what you should be hearing. And so it's quite interesting to have sort of been brave enough to play these songs live before we've heard them on record. I admire you for doing it, and it kept, certainly Saturday, it kept the show feeling sort of fresh and credible, because you've got so many live songs that are sort of set pieces that you play regularly now, that it was good to see you being daring enough to sort of throw in these new songs. But I'm curious about that decision, when clearly sonics are such a part of this new record.
Yeah, I mean, I think we kept it, like, for me, I just tried to like play some limitations. Like, for example, like on Whole Love, I was like, you know, I would like to try to not play piano on this album. Like, I don't, it's dawned on me, but like for the most part, everything else is like electronics or organs or synthetic. And for this one, I was just more interested in, like, you know, in the sonics to a degree, but just more like the sort of like finding new ways to sort of play piano. And I think that, you know, it's a testament to the songwriting that these songs do translate live as a piece of music that we can all perform together. and then sort of like parallel, it exists on the record as well. You know, they're close, but there's you know, they're like parasitic relationship. They both sort of feed off of each other. And then the songs, after we play them over and over again, we kind of like get in deeper into them. And like, we just played Colbert last night, and the part that I play on Everyone Hides just, you know, didn't work, you know, with Glenn's drums right behind me. And so I was like, oh, I need to change this to make it, to make this part happen. And it's like, oh, wow, I might just play that like that from now on. But I mean, like, new music is always, you know, it's always been part of the Wilco, like, mission statement. Like, keep pushing, keep exploring, and try to satisfy that mysterious portion of the Venn diagram between, like, you know, our personal creative satisfactions and, you know, like a perceived fan or something like that, you know.
How do you feel? I guess I threw kind of two elements there. One is the live element, and one is the concept of Wilco albums becoming Jeff albums with Wilco overdubs. You know, is that, I don't know, how do you feel about that? Or do you think that the end result is ultimately going to be, your DNA is still going to be there regardless of how the record is made?
Yeah, I think that, you know, on this record, you really can hear all of us in it. Yeah, I mean, I think to sort of say that it's like a Jeff album with Wilco overdubs is probably like a little bit less than accurate. It's just sort of like, you know, Jeff's in the studio, you know, I mean, it's like his full-time job when we're not out on the road,
yeah.
You know, so he's just keeps working on it. And then, you know, he sent us a list of songs. We're like, oh, we like that one. That one's great. And let's work on that one. And so it wasn't just sort of like, here, do this, you know. There was some exchange involved, and yeah, I mean, I think we all have learned how to sort of like contort ourselves into 3 to 5 minutes of music that allows us to like be present but not to serve the song in our own unique ways.
Yeah. How much do you get let in on what the songs are about? I mean, do you ask Jeff to explain lyrics to you, or do you keep the mystery? Because a lot of them are quite oblique. Do you keep the mystery to yourself? Do you, or, you know, have you ever had issues with one of Jeff's lyrics, been unhappy with it? Or how does that relationship work? Or do you just distance yourself from it?
You know, it's I've never been like, I always hear the music first, even with like Sinatra records. Like, I just always hear like sort of the band and the music. Like, that's what I hear first. And it isn't until, I don't know, like in the last year or two, that I realized that the lyrics are what songs are about. Right. And like, again, it's like an embarrassing admission, but like, I've always just like heard the music and felt the music first. I mean, not always, but like more often than not. And when it comes to Jeff, you know, he's really great at putting these evocative phrases and things together. And I just sort of, you know, hear them and feel them. But there's not really a lot of discussion about lyrics, or like, oh, this, you know, that should be the verse and that should be the chorus or anything like that. Or, you know, it's like that's kind of his purview, and rightly so, in a way. He's quite good at it, so but there, you know, we played at the Solid Sound Festival at Mass Mocha every 2 years, and we played this last one. We had a like sort of little contest where we asked fans to submit videos of themselves that they would come up and sing karaoke with Wilco.
Yeah.
And they had the lyrics on a big screen behind us and on some monitors at the front of the stage, so the singers could follow along if they didn't know all of them or something.
Sure.
And it was really funny, because like, I kind of can't keep my eyes off it, because I'm like, oh, right, that's what that song's about. you know, it's just, my role and my obligations to the song. Like, I just sort of, you know, consider them my, you know, like, these are my responsibilities to perform the song. And then, like, oh, that's what that's about, right? Of course. I think, does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does.
Okay.
How much of an emotional experience is it playing with Wilco? Because, I mean, we sort of show Saturday at London, and I was in a bit of a bad place. We had a bit of a nightmare that day, and I've OCD as well, and so I was in a bit of a funny mood at night. But it was an incredible show, and my wife, I didn't find out till afterwards, she said that she cried twice, but it wasn't because the songs were, it wasn't like because it was one of the sad songs or something like that. She just said that the band was so good that it was just so I think it was Impossible Germany, and At Least That's What You Said. Those two songs, when the band just on fire, it was just like, you know, this is what a band can do. The last band we went to see, which I won't name, they make very beautiful records, but the live show was seriously lacking. And Wilco, just the textbook, no, you don't have to settle for that. This is how you play live, and this is how you honour what the songs sound like on record, but you expand them, not in a way that irritates fans, but in a way that makes them even better. And you just create this diverse, powerful show that is just, you know, quite overwhelming in places. And I wonder what it's like to go through that every night. You know, what's the relationship of head versus heart, you know?
It's awfully nice to hear, and those are kind words. And but it's a bit of a, you know, it's a bit of both, you know, like there's this kind of constant back and forth where you have to, like, even like within the sort of the parameters of a show, you have to figure out a way to kind of like let loose and just be sort of as uninhibited as you can. And in my case, as a Northern European uptight white person, a little harder for me. but and then there's like all the sort of the technical things, like, oh, this song's coming up and I need to make that keyboard ready with that sound, and I had to make sure that volume is set, you know. So there's like, you kind of get grounded in some of the technical moments. And but I guess maybe also what winds up happening is, like, you know, this the songs, you know, they grow with us over the years. I mean, we've been playing At Least That's What You Said for I don't know, as long as it's like I've been in the band, basically, you know. Yeah. So it's like almost 20 years, and you really understand the sort of the, you know, we know that song on a kind of like molecular level, and there's, you know, there's an amount of restraint that, and maybe not restraint, but there's like, yeah, there's a like, in trying to honor the song and the spirit of the song, there's times to become free and loose and improvise. There's a lot of latitude in Wilco, but it's not in the sort of like, you know, like Impossible Germany is a long guitar solo song. But there aren't really, like, that is like kind of like a, you know, it's a cornerstone, I suppose, of a Wilco show, but it's not like, it's not every song has a long guitar solo, so like sort of rammed in the middle of it, you know?
No.
So I think it's like the kind of like the diversity of the material keeps it interesting. And, you know, like for me, I've gone to in-ear monitors this year for the first time. Huh. And so it's like a different experience, but I can actually hear myself even better than I ever had before. And so I feel like I'm able to even kind of further clarify my ideas and my like sounds. And that makes me kind of even more energized. It's like, oh, now I can really with like more precision hear what I'm doing. I can hear like what Pat's doing instead of this kind of like this big fuzzy warm roar that'll happen. But again, it's like, as far as like heart and head, I mean, it's like, I don't think we'll ever stop playing, you know, quote unquote, big dumb rock songs, you know, which I don't, it's not a disparaging term. It's just like, you know, they're just, it's fun and it's like a release and it's like, there's a catharsis involved and like music just has that sort of, it has that power to just sort of like transcend time and space. And we get to share that, I suppose, with audiences.
I've said this before, I can't remember who it was that came on the show, but it amazes me what a band and an audience and music can do to a room. You know, what can happen when you take, you know, even like an aircraft hangar of a place and you put, you know, the E Street Band in there or Wilco in there and an audience, and the absolute magic that can happen in a space with those factors.
Right.
It's just incredible. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, but I mean, I feel like it's that, you know, it's just some way that we can all share in that sort of like that infinite mysterious quality of being a human being.
I noticed there was quite a few kids at the show on Saturday. So we were up in a balcony. we were second row of a balcony, and in front of us there was a couple that had brought three kids with them, and then I think the row behind us, further along, there was like two young boys with their dad, I presume. I mean, I guess it was like a Saturday night, so like you know, no school the next day. Have you noticed more kids at the shows in recent years?
You know, I get a very skewed sampling of what the audience is. I can see, you know, usually into like just like the first, you know, half a dozen rows.
Okay, yeah.
You know, so there's a lot of the audience that I don't get to sort of like sample.
Yeah.
But yeah, there. I mean, you know, as we age, so do our fans, and they evolve. Like as we have, you know, grown families and are sort of sharing this experience with their families, and it's, you know, that's amazing and beautiful.
Yeah. Will there be a Wilco in 10 years?
I don't see any reason why not. I mean, I feel one of the, Jeff's talked about this, that he just sees like, it just feels like there's so much more to do. And, I also am like parallel to Wilco, been just sort of like, you know, kind of going back to school as it were, and discovering, you know, going deeper into like piano players and finding like just like this, just, I mean, like an amazing treasure trove of inspiration from obvious people who don't maybe have any direct relationship to like a rock band, but, you know, Bill Evans, of course, and Art Tatum and Oscar Peterson, and just drilling down on these guys and learning what it is that they do and trying to find the appropriate time within the kind of context of a Wilco song, like what that is and sounds like. And that's been sort of evident in some of the stuff on the new record, like Bright Leaves, just like trying to push myself to find a, you know, some different colors that I haven't utilized within Wilco, but that still works and doesn't turn it into a kind of a jazz rock thing, you know. But I mean, as long as we all stay healthy and eating well and treating ourselves well on the road, and like, I don't see why not, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited for the record on Friday. I have the vinyl, although I don't have a home currently to play it.
Oh.
yeah, I'm really excited to hear it. Do you think you'll be Do you think you'll be back to Europe once the album's out? Do you know if that's going to happen next year, or is it unclear yet?
I don't know, like specifically when, but there have been discussions about coming back in the spring, summer, most likely. So, yeah.
What happened last time? Yeah. Because on the last tour, you announced it as the Star Wars tour, so I booked to see you. And it was like over a year in advance the tour got put on sale. And by the time the tour came over, Schmielko was out. And so it sort of turned into the Schmielko tour by the time you actually,
right.
The show's actually happened. So, yeah, I guess it'd be nice to see Ode to Joy while it's still Ode to Joy and the record's out. Because
right. I know. Well, you have.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we played 7 songs from the record that night, I think. Like, it's like a good chunk of the set.
Yeah.
You know.
It's a different experience hearing it before the record's out, though, isn't it? You know?
Oh, yeah, sure, of course. But, you know, look who just does things its own way. No, I'd love to come back.
Yeah. Thank you so much for doing this, mate. It's been really nice.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah, me hope, same here.
Look after yourself, mate.
Yeah, thanks. You too.
All right. Take care, buddy. Bye.
All right. Bye.
I'm so happy Michael came on the show, and he was so generous with his time. I was thinking about our conversation, and in particular the lengthy process the band went through in the past to make some of their records that they now try and circumvent. And A Ghost Is Born may have taken forever to make, but at their recent London show, they still played 5 songs from it all these years later. Making art doesn't have to be painful. I know frontman Jeff Tweedy was going through some horrendous stuff at the time, and of course I wouldn't want him to go through everything he was going through personally again, but sometimes the hard work itself really does pay off. I hope Wilco keep fighting to find that right balance. Thanks as always this month to our guests, whose opinions are their own. Thanks also to Sam Draper. Until next time.